my intern year.
What is his plan?
I don't know.
I got this one this morning.
We should. Good morning. Open the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue. Hope everyone had a good weekend. We have a number today, for those who have traveled down to the Capitol, is the last day to introduce bills. And so we have like 8 or 9 bills because this is it. This is the first step in closing down a legislative session, is stopping the introduction of bills. So we're going to introduce 8 or 9 committee bills, and then we'll get right into Senate Bill 38. Paul.
Mr. Chair, I believe I have 7 bills for you. And I can go through them real quickly. LC 2377 is a bill that permits the assessor to correct errors in valuation judgment any time during an appeal. I believe we have a similar measure in the House. LC 2378 provides for treatment of property transferred from taxable entity to tax-exempt entity. And that's 2378. 2793 provides that property held by exempt entity that is subleased to another exempt entity is also exempt. So it's a clarification on property tax exemption.
Paul, what number was that one?
That was LC 2793.
Thank you.
LC 3457 is one that we've talked about that we had requested on interest earnings for rainy day funds, and this is basically a placeholder that requires that interest earnings from general fund be deposited into reserve fund. So that's an issue you talked about in Senate Bill 48. LC 3678 changes the way that surplus kicker refunds are treated. It turns them, goes back to the pre-95 statute in which they were treated as a credit rather than a refund. So it wouldn't affect the total amount, it just affects how they're returned to taxpayers. LC 3713, these are two that we just received this morning. LC 2313 modifies the laws governing people's utility districts. And then LC 3575 creates a task force on Oregon Strategic Forest Reserve.
Questions for Paul about the 7 LC drafts for introduction? Senator George.
Well, I'm missing one of them. You, Paul, following 3457, what was the number on that one? Because I got 2 numbers on it. Okay, you got it. Right, here we go.
3575.
You want to do them one at a time, Mr. Chairman?
All at once, if we can.
All right.
Did you get this last one?
I think so. That was the one I was missing, which is 3457. Yeah. No? You're missing it.
3575. 3457.
It was after 3457. I think there was another one.
3678.
I'll just read them off to make sure we got it.
Okay. All right.
2377. 2793. And 3575.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that all the bills that have just been read by Paul be accepted as committee bills. So LC drafts, pardon me.
No problem. He doesn't have to repeat that.
Yeah. I can do that.
So right? Moved.
Okay.
Senator George has moved that all the bills mentioned by Paul Warner will be introduced as all the LCs as committee bills. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 38. Sign those. And looks like Mary is staffing. Mm-hmm. Mary, this is a part of the affordable housing group's agenda. What does this bill do?
Well, this bill will establish a fee for recording documents in deeds and mortgage records of the county, and it directs the county clerk to transfer these fees to the Department of Housing and Community Services in order to fund its housing program. The bill is an outcome of the Senate and House Interim Revenue Committee's summit that was held during the interim session on more affordable housing. And during that time, quite a bit of data was presented over three different meetings. And it was I also presented some background material which indicated that as of 2004, roughly half a million households spent more than 30% of their income on housing costs, including utilities. And according to the Housing and Urban Development Department, use of 30% is a threshold above which housing is considered unaffordable. The percentage of households spending more than 30% of their income on housing in 2004 varied across counties, but some of these percentages were substantially higher in Multnomah, Marion, and Lynn counties. During the summit, alternatives were presented during, for expanding the number of affordable housing units in Oregon, and one of the alternatives presented there is represented in this bill.
Great. Thank you. Questions for Mary?
Mr. Chair,
Senator Monroe.
Would this bill allow for money to be expended to maintain or create mobile home parks as low-income housing?
Is that a question?
Yeah.
I'm not sure if it would, although there is another bill that being considered at the time that would bring affordable housing in mobile homes under the purview of the department. It's being suggested in another House bill, I believe. So this would, if both bills were passed, I believe this would also allow the department to fund non-profit cooperative mobile home parks. So there is a sort of an area there that would be covered by that.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, the reason I ask the question is there's a crisis in our state in low-income housing, of course, but also there's a crisis in the fact that manufactured housing has provided a source of low-income housing for many, many years in this state, and because of land use pressures and so on, many of those parks are closing and being converted to other uses, and there's virtually no new ones being sited. And it seems to me that that makes up a major component of low-income housing and is a component that needs to be protected if we're going to have a good mix of low-income opportunities for people.
Great. And if folks are testifying, if someone knows the answer to that, boy, they're good. They all, this side of the room, all nodded at once. So an answer to that, I think, will be included in our first panels. So I'm going to go in order. Selma and Clarence Eckstein and Lori Dwight.
You should start with the other page.
So we have structured testimony. You're right. It's all in one person's handwriting. So that means. So we're going to start with Bill Hall, Cindy Cook, and Janet Bird. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Deckert, members of the committee. My name is Bill Hall. I am a Lincoln County Commissioner, and I chair the steering committee that is developing our county's 10-year affordable housing plan with a focus on chronic homelessness. I am also co-chair of the Oregon Ending Homelessness Advisory Council. I want to take just a couple of minutes to talk to you about why housing and homelessness have become among the most critical issues we are facing on the Central Coast. Also want to let you know that Lincoln County is one of the newest members of the Housing Alliance, a statewide coalition that brings together a diverse group of organizations and interests who believe that housing must be a priority for state spending. According to the best information that we've been able to put together from a variety of sources, more than 1,600 people, almost 4% of the population of Lincoln County, experienced homelessness at some point last year. More than 400 of them are school-aged children. That's more than 7% of our district's enrollment. Children in unstable living situations have greater difficulty learning, which makes it more challenging for them to succeed later in life. The price of housing and rentals in Lincoln County has climbed much faster than the growth of wages. Our rental prices are the highest of any rural market in Oregon. This has made it much more difficult for hardworking families to find decent, safe, affordable housing. And this is making it harder for businesses to attract and retain workers. Several nurses at the hospital in Lincoln City are commuting from McMinnville because they can't find places to live. Last summer, our countywide school district hired 35 new teachers, but five of them ended up declining the positions, and in every case, it was because of housing costs. Chronically homeless people consume a disproportionate share of community resources. This includes hospital emergency room visits, jail and court time, mental health and addictions treatment, and more. But I think the most significant thing to know about the Lincoln County story is that it's not an aberration. It's typical. While the details change from one part of the state to another, the story is the same. As an elected official, I'm aware of the many competing and compelling demands for limited public resources. But I believe the agenda of the Housing Alliance addresses one of our most fundamental needs right now, and the bill you are considering today, Senate Bill 38, creates a dedicated funding source that is appropriate and reasonable for the well-being of our communities, our families, and especially our children. I respectfully urge you to vote yes on Senate Bill 38. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator George.
Did you notice the voice with Mr. Hall? Mr. Hall in my old district was a broadcaster. And he used to ask me questions on the air. And I'm not going to ask him any questions right now. Thanks.
You feel free to ask away if you want to.
He's right. It's a problem on the coast.
It sure seems that 7% was for public school students was surprisingly high to hear.
That's probably the statistic that people in the community find the most shocking of all. And they've asked me to see what we can do, and I think this is the best approach.
Oh. Well, thank you for traveling to the Capitol today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Yes, ma'am.
You're a tough act to follow. Chair Deckard, members of the committee, thank you. I'm here from Central Oregon. My name is Cindy Cook, and I am the Executive Director of Housing Works. We are a local housing authority serving Deschutes, Jefferson, and Crook County. I'm here to talk about the need for workforce housing, in particular in our area. Last year, we commissioned a study, the Workforce Housing Needs Assessment, that was released in July of 2006. You're probably familiar with it, but I did want to highlight some of the findings that came out of that needs assessment. Central Oregon, as you've all known, those of you who have visited lately have seen that it's exploding in growth, and it has become quite the lifestyle community. Our population is driven not by jobs, but by this lifestyle. And we have many baby boomers who are moving in, and that has created a very interesting dilemma in our housing market, because as builders are meeting their demands, there's a demand for a much higher end housing. The folks that are coming up behind, who are actually providing all the services, those that are pouring the drinks, those who are changing the sheets in motel rooms, landscaping, etc., are the ones that are really struggling and being locked out of the housing market. In addition to that, we have a modest supply of affordable housing. In the past 10 years, we've seen a significant decline of federal commitment in terms of housing dollar resources. And as our area being rural, many of those housing dollars were delivered to much larger metropolitan areas. So Central Oregon was behind the curve on the federal dollars, let alone being able to keep pace once this incredible population explosion hit. Our organization, through partnerships, have been able to deliver a significant, in a very short time, a significant amount of housing for some of the most vulnerable populations and some of the workforce, but it's still not enough to meet the demand. And I want to talk about that for just a moment. The workforce housing demand, which is amazing to me when I really look at these numbers, that in 2008, we will have a shortage of over 8,000 units. 3,000 of those units are going to be short just in the folks who are working in the service and trade arena, and they are making 50% or below of area median income. That seems like a daunting number by 2008. Honestly, I don't think there's a magic pill to hand out. But through Senate Bill 38, what we will be able to accomplish is to have some additional sources of funds that we can leverage federal and state dollars. As you know, we can't do it alone. We have to have some assistance from those federal low-income housing tax credits, from home funds, and other dollars that are block granted out to the state of Oregon. But in order to really get those programs in place and into areas, we need leveraged capital to fund the gaps. And so I urge you all to look at Senate Bill 38, support Senate Bill 38. It's an important tool for us, particularly once we get outside the metropolitan area, to really make a significant difference. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Janet Bird, and I'm the Executive Director of the Neighborhood Partnership Fund, which is a statewide organization providing support and training to nonprofit developers. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today about Senate Bill 38. Senate Bill 38 is the cornerstone of the Housing Alliance's $100 million housing opportunity agenda. It establishes, as Cindy referenced, an ongoing dedicated revenue source to help Oregon's communities meet their housing needs. I'm going to speak today about the details of the bill and then introduce a series of speakers who will give you some more details and specific outcomes of our plans to use the revenues raised to meet critical housing needs. And just as a preview, we will talk about manufactured home parks in some detail. So what Senate Bill 38 does is raise the already existing state-imposed fee on the first page of real estate documents, and it raises that fee by $15. You'll see I submitted a page with my testimony of proposed amendments. I did also see there's an LC draft of amendments. Some of our proposed amendments didn't quite make it in the proposed amendments that LC did. The number is correct. So increasing that state imposed fee, which is now $11, by $15. The specific transactions that this would apply to are spelled out in ORS 205-130. Essentially, it's a broad group of transactions that affect the title of real estate. The fee will be collected by the counties and then sent to the treasurer for forwarding to Housing and Community Services. This is all an existing collection mechanism and transfer mechanism, so it doesn't create any additional administrative burden. The other thing that Senate Bill 38 does is allocate revenues within Housing and Community Services accounts. The proposed amendments contain, on my list, contain the correct account names and percentages. There was a mistake in the LC draft. They didn't take out two words from one of the account names. And I think Mary's pretty familiar with our proposed amendments. Yeah.
But we do not have them back from LC.
We don't have them back until the 6th.
I think they came back very late on Friday. So I have a copy. You don't? I'm sorry. I assumed you would have a copy. I'll make sure that this gets, I only have one copy, but I'll make sure it gets passed and shared with staff. So if you look at my, this contains, this is the third page, I think, of my testimony. This contains the recommended amendments and goes down by line. So what we've done, again, in allocating the revenues, the fee revenues, is that we've used existing accounts within Housing and Community Services, and all of those accounts allow for competitive allocation of the funds and flexible use of the funds to best meet changing community housing needs and priorities. To the extent possible, all of the funds would be administered using existing processes, allocated competitively, and allocated statewide based on community needs and priorities, which might be changed or established by rule. And you'll see there's language in the amendments to allow that those priorities will be visited by in rulemaking. So 81% of the fee revenue would go to the housing development account for use in two categories. 75% of that 81 will go to multifamily housing via the housing development account. And that's to build and preserve at least 1,000 units of rental housing and manufactured home park spaces. Again, these funds are allocated competitively, primarily using the existing consolidated funding cycle, which follows statutory guidelines for income and distribution and geographic distribution targets. 6% of the fee revenue will support a competitive, priority-driven capacity building and evaluation program. These funds will ensure the best use of housing development resources, ensure capable management of the developed assets, support efforts to increase home ownership, and provide for external evaluation of programs to ensure that we maximize performance and impact. 10% of the fee revenue will go out to community action agencies by existing formula to support efforts to end and prevent homelessness. 9% of the fee revenue will be used to support home ownership opportunities, including construction subsidy in some market areas where just a little bit of down payment assistance is not enough to get people into home ownership. The proposed amendments also increase the flexibility of Housing and Community Services as we work to address the need for affordable home ownership opportunities. Existing statutory language in ORS 458-655 limits the use of home ownership assistance account funds for construction. We want to change the limits in recognition of the need in some markets to subsidize construction and development costs for home ownership. We also want to explicitly allow land banking and shared equity models. So the next two panels of speakers, I'd be happy to take questions, but the next two panels of speakers will walk in more detail through the proposed uses and what we expect to achieve in terms of the number of units produced. The handout attached to my testimony also gives you more detail on the account names and the uses that we anticipate. So you've heard speakers already today address the critical level of need faced by Oregon's communities. What I'd like to add is that it's important that you also recognize that we're poised to meet those needs. Oregon's community-based housing developers, including community development corporations and housing authorities, are some of the most recognized and noted in the country. Our developers regularly win national awards, routinely bring in millions in leveraged funds from the private sector, the federal government, and foundations. We're known nationally for our creativity, our integrity, and our capacity. What we need and what you can provide is an ongoing, reliable, significant funding source, such as that provided in Senate Bill 38. So thank you for your attention and your support. I'd be happy to walk through details, or we can do that at a later time if you want to do that.
Thank you, Janet. Questions for this panel? Yes, Senator Monroe.
What's the annual revenue that this measure will create?
That's a good question. I didn't say that, did I? We anticipate that at the $15 level, if we were to get a full biennium's worth of revenue, it would be about $60 million. And that was how we came up with the $15 fee. And I believe the research that Mary has done supports that $15 number. In the 2007-2009 biennium, we might be a little bit, depending on when the fee goes into effect and starts to be collected, we might collect a little less than that, $60 million.
So once it's up and running, it's about $30 million a year.
Mm-hmm.
And Mary's indicating it might be a shade higher than that. 63 is the note she made to me.
Yeah, it's a little hard to figure out exactly what the documents are going to end up being. Yeah.
And Janet, if you could show us your testimony. We're digging around looking for it. If you have a copy in front of you, and we're trying to find the amendments that you are, and we have
a
number of...
Yeah, you do.
Talk about document recording fees.
It was paper-clipped together. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah.
Should be a set of five or six pages altogether.
That's an idea. We could fee into the testimony.
That's true. We do a fee on this and we'll go up to $65 million. Okay. So I have it. Senator George has it. Okay. We're good to go.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And if we could do this, if we could have one more panel of advocates and then let the opponents have a panel before we just continue on, just in fairness. And I have John Van Landingham next.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Berg. Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. So John Van Landingham from Lane County, Martha McQuinnon, and Bill Van Vliet from the Network for Affordable Housing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Van Landingham. I work as a lawyer for Lane County Legal Aid. I am here to answer Senator Monroe's question. I believe that I'm spending most of my life these days on manufactured housing park closures. We don't know exactly how many closures have occurred. There is no requirement that park landlords report a closure to the state. Housing and Human Services has been trying to keep track of that number, but it requires voluntary efforts in many cases. We believe, HCS believes, mm-hmm. that within the past 2 years, 31 parks have closed, displacing at least 1,500 people. We know that parks have closed in the Portland metro area, in Salem-Keizer, in Bend, in Medford, and in Roseburg. Even in communities where there have not been closures, the fear of closure, such as in my own community in Eugene, Springfield, fear of closure is having an impact on park residents. Some of the parks that have closed are older parks that may have reached the end of their useful lives. But many of the parks that are closing are newer parks with residents who never expected that this would occur. And those closures in many cases are being driven by the increased value of the land and the fact that those parks are on big pieces of land. With little investment in infrastructure, well-serviced, and development in those communities has reached those areas. They were built in the fringe in the 80s, 70s, and now development in those communities has spread out, and those are prime development sites. Oddly enough, another target of these developments development pressure is golf courses inside urban growth boundaries. Some similar features, although nobody lives on the golf course. In a park closure, many tenants, for various reasons, are going to lose their home. They're unable to move the home. Even those park residents who can move the home are going to have to pay between $15,000 and $25,000 to move it. $15,000 to $25,000 to move it. All of those residents are going to lose their communities, their networks, their friends, their access to hospitals, transportation. In many ways, a park closure is a tragedy for those residents. And as Senator Monroe has noted, it's a significant loss in affordable housing for our state. Senate Bill 38 is part of the approach that us manufactured housing park advocates are taking in this session. And my handout, which has my name handwritten in the top left-hand, right-hand corner, your left, lists the different things that we're doing. I work with a group called the Manufactured Housing Landlord Tenant Coalition. It's a coalition of park residents and park landlords and manufacturers and other interest groups. And we have a bill, HB 2735, which sets out the coalition's proposal for addressing park closures, helping residents deal with the closure. And that's the first item on that two-page document that has my name on it. That proposal will require park landlords to pay residents between $5,000 and $9,000 based on the size of their home. It will expand and continue a tax credit that the last legislature passed, what I sometimes refer to as the Son of Crummel bill. It's HB 2600, but it's also in 2735, that bill. That bill also will be introduced in the Senate through Senator Vakian. And it requires landlords to negotiate with tenants in good faith to see if the tenants or a nonprofit can buy the park. On the page of paper that I've handed you, the items below that first one have to do with a strategy of trying to help preserve parks as affordable housing, either through purchase by residents, resident co-ops, or nonprofits or housing authorities. So the first item on that page deals with where the park's going to close. We're not going to stop the park closure, but we're going to try and assist those tenants in dealing with the costs of moving. The rest of the page, that first page and the second page, had to do with trying to preserve the park as affordable housing. First thing we're doing is trying to create something called a manufactured dwelling park nonprofit cooperative. In Oregon law, you can't be both a cooperative and a nonprofit. This will allow a nonprofit cooperative. We're following a model from New Hampshire, where New Hampshire has assisted over 80 parks residents to form cooperatives and buy their parks, preserving 4,500 spaces in the last 25 years. It's a great model. We're going to try and duplicate it here. The third item on my list is an expansion of the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit. That tax credit has been in existence since 1989. It's used to develop new rental housing. The expansion will allow it to be used, the tax credit to be used, to buy manufactured housing parks. Our strategy is that money will leverage private money from groups like Bill Van Vliet, who's going to talk to you in a minute. Private money, about 80% of the purchase price of a park. The other 20% of the purchase price of the park is going to come, we hope, from Senate Bill 38. So while Senate Bill 38 does not explicitly call out parks, the strategy of all of us who've been working this way is that the money from Senate Bill 38 will go a long ways to helping us buy parks, the 20% that we can't borrow, and perhaps build some new parks. The last thing I want to mention is item six on my list, technical assistance. We have a nonprofit in the Newburgh area, CASA, which is statewide, which will work with Community Development Law Center to provide technical assistance to residents to help buy their parks. That's more than my 3 minutes. I'm sorry.
Thank you. No, thank you, Mr. Van Landingham. Thank you for your work on this. How does the 20% flow? So how will you access, if we pass Senate Bill 38 and you're looking for that final 20%, how will you access that with passage of this bill?
Senator Deckard, our strategy is that we have CASA working now, trying to find parks with willing sellers and residents that are interested in buying. When we identify a park such as that, and I guess I should back up a little bit more. HB 2735 will require selling landlords to notify Housing Community Services of the intent to sell. It will also require landlords to negotiate in good faith with resident co-ops, nonprofits, CDCs that are working with the residents for a 60-day period to see whether the residents can compete. It's not a first right of refusal, but it's a requirement that the landlords negotiate in good faith to see if they can buy the park. If they can, then Housing Community Services will notify CASA. CASA will work with the tenants, develop a proposal, make that offer. If we get that offer, then CASA and the residents will apply to the Housing Community Services for funding through the Senate Bill 38 money, the 20% down payment, and then work with a lender such as NOAA to borrow the other 80%. Does that answer your question?
It does.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Martha McLennan. I'm the executive director of Northwest Housing Alternatives. We're a nonprofit based in Clackamas County that provides affordable housing. We currently have housing that serves over 2,000 individuals around the state. We have properties in 14 Oregon counties. The average income of those households is less than $15,000 a year. I'm going to talk about two particular topics within affordable housing. One is preservation, and the other is special needs housing and homelessness. So first, preservation. Over the last 20 to 30 years, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, in combination with the state, has developed over 12,000 units of affordable housing. Now, these units made long-term commitments to maintain affordability, but that period of time is running out. At this point, we know that those 12,000 units are at risk between now and the year 2011. There are a variety of strategies to attempt to preserve those properties, including acquisitions by nonprofits, which is one of the things that I'm interested in for my agency. These units are widely dispersed throughout the state, and in many small communities, they're the only affordable housing stock in those neighborhoods or in those towns. Northwest Housing Alternatives in about a decade ago was involved in acquisition of affordable housing preservation projects and acquired properties in Salem, Monmouth, Hermiston, Gladstone, and Hines. We're right now looking at a portfolio of six properties that we'd like to preserve in this round. They include properties in Portland, Medford, Bend, and again in Hermiston. The beauty of these properties is that they can be preserved for a much smaller investment than new affordable housing. So we're hoping that this will be one of the priority kinds of projects that will be served by Senate Bill 38's revenues. The other topic that I want to talk about is homeless and special needs. Northwest Housing Alternatives has a significant portfolio of special needs properties. It includes properties that serve people with developmental disabilities, people suffering from mental illness, people with HIV, people with alcohol and drug treatment, and people in the treatment courts in Clackamas County. We also provide shelter for homeless families in Clackamas County and transitional housing for those families. Last night at our shelter, the Annie Ross House, we had 18 people staying in the shelter. 14 of those were kids. In Clackamas County, the homeless population, 70% of the homeless population is families that includes kids. So it's a very big problem, and particularly, I think, in the suburbs, a problem that includes more families and more children. One of the purposes of the funds from Senate Bill 38 is specifically dedicated to the emergency housing account. Those funds would be distributed through an allocation by county and could support shelters such as the Annie Ross House. In addition, the basic funding within Senate Bill 38 would provide resources that could provide a full continuum of affordable housing that can serve people who have been homeless or people with special needs in settings which provide both the housing that they need at affordable rents as well as the supportive services that they need to remain stable. Within this area of special needs housing and homeless housing, one of the things that I want to point out to you is that these are programs that attract private dollars, not just the private equity or debt that we see in typical affordable housing, but also private foundation funds. In the metropolitan area, we're working on a project called Bridges to Housing, which has recently attracted grant foundation from both the Meyer Trust and from the Gates Foundation. So the dollars that you provide here at the state are leveraged well and create valuable public-private partnerships to ensure that people will be stable and have a place to call home. Thank you.
Thank you, Martha. Questions? Mr. Blake.
Thank you, Chair Deckert, members of the committee. My name is Bill Van Bleet, and I'm the Executive Director of NOAA, the Network for Oregon Affordable Housing. And NOAA is a statewide nonprofit consortium of Oregon banks. We were founded in 1990 to finance affordable housing rental projects statewide. My job today is to talk about the multifamily housing production that will be produced under Senate, the document recording fee from Senate Bill 38. and more specifically our production targets for the multifamily section. And I do have a handout. Hopefully it's made its way around. It's got my name on the upper left-hand corner, just very generic-looking white sheet of paper.
Some attachments. Letterhead or,
pardon?
No letterhead?
No, I'm sorry. I didn't get the letterhead on this morning. That handout has some additional background information that I'm not going to go into. It's there for your reference if you choose to look at it, but it discusses a little bit about the need for subsidy in serving these populations. New resources are desperately needed to meet the housing needs of low-income Oregonians. And as I have been listening, I'm reminded of some research NOAA did for a recent federal funding application where we gathered statistics of our statewide housing affordability gaps, and it's a very sobering list, and I'll try and remember to provide that to you as a follow-up piece of information. In summary, though, we rank near the bottom for housing affordability in many, many major categories. Senate Bill 38 is an attempt to try to get at that problem. What's important with this funding source is that it is a predictable and dedicated and recurring funding source. Our projects have very long timelines for development, and we need to have that predictability in order to keep our pipelines moving on a steady pace. The document recording fee does this. This resource will also open up other resources that are out there that are powerful financing tools, such as tax-exempt bonds and the related 4% federal tax credits that go with those bonds. Those resources are currently underutilized because there's a gap required to make those projects work in a lot of communities. These resources will help fill that gap and open up those other resources to us. We have a number of funding strategies that are employed currently. We have lots of partners like Martha's standing by, ready to proceed. What's missing is this gap funding that this bill will provide. So more specifically, what kinds of projects do we expect to fund? We're going to meet a wide range of community needs. These will include farm worker housing, special needs housing projects that have services attached with them that Martha just described, downtown revitalization projects, family housing, workforce housing, and a wide range of affordability within each of those groups. Because the amount of subsidy needed for each of these varies greatly depending on the level of affordability, the location of the project, the unit sizes within that project, and what other resources might be available, it's hard to predict exactly what the production levels will be. But still, we've created a chart that gives you some examples of how this may unfold once we have this resource available to us. So if you look at the chart that's attached, I'll just explain it real briefly. Yours won't have the handwritten notes, but it looks like this. Basically, we are breaking it down into four categories of production. Multifamily housing developments in general will encompass a wide range of affordability and unit types. The at-risk HUD projects that Martha just described, again, are those that are reaching the end of their term under the HUD contracts that provide operating and rental subsidies for their operations. We anticipate using this resource to help acquire those, to preserve those very valuable operating and rental subsidies that the federal government provides. We are dedicating 20%, or proposing to dedicate 20% of the multifamily resources towards special needs populations. This includes the permanent supportive housing efforts happening that Martha discussed, primarily aiming at ending homelessness for individuals and families and preventing homelessness for those who are on the verge of losing their housing. These projects involve a high degree of public of social services that help people succeed in their housing. The other thing that we are anticipating using these resources for, again, gets to the manufactured home parks that John discussed. We're very committed to that. We know it's a very important issue. I actually am optimistic that we can find private funding for more than the 80% and even reduce the amount of public subsidy we'll need so we can touch more of these parks with the same amount of money. But we're still working on these models, and so we'll see how they shake out. But I'm models that I've run show that we should be able to get even better leverage out of private resources for that. So in conclusion, my comments, this resource will leverage private capital in the form of loans, tax credit investments, and bond purchases. And my rough estimates are that these projects will bring in $60 to $70 million of private sector capital to match the $45 million of public. It may be higher. It will provide desperately needed housing in our communities. It's affordable to a wide range of households. And, you know, the need is great. We have efficient systems in place to deliver the housing. We have capable organizations. We have projects that are ready to proceed and are in the queue for development. The only missing ingredient is this gap funding that we desperately need to get these projects moving forward. It's really hampered our ability to house low-income Oregonians. So I urge your support, Senate Bill 38.
Great. Thank you. Questions for this panel, Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Van Vliet, just if you can repeat the statistics you just said about how much money this is going to leverage. You just said it. I didn't.
Yes. My numbers are anywhere between $60 and $70 million of private sector capital, and I really think it'll probably be more than that. I've been pretty conservative in my production projections that are in this chart and in the leverage. And I think we'll beat both of those. I think we'll produce more units, and I think we'll get better leverage. But I didn't want to promise that up here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So, Bill or Martha, one of the attractive features of the lender's tax credit was the simplicity that the money flowed, and it was easy to visualize the production and see the housing. And I've yet to get that type of clarity, although you talked about it, Bill, but I think it would be helpful, and maybe Victor Merced, who's going to testify later, could also hammer that point home of how this money will be out on the street, building units, housing families, and then to ensure some of the work that this committee has done is to ensure it actually goes to those who need it and does not get siphoned away into areas that don't meet the test of affordable housing.
The allocation method for distributing most of the funds in this bill is through competitive processes administered by Housing and Community Services. Those processes are involve a very elaborate application, just submitted one on Friday. They call for a very detailed needs analysis in the community, a market analysis of the community, a capacity analysis of the project sponsor, and a very, very long-term commitment to affordable housing. Part of the scoring of that application process looks to the depth of affordability that can be achieved and to the length of commitment that the project sponsor is willing to make to affordability. Within affordable housing, it's a layer cake of different types of funding sources. So we look to having private equity from the low-income housing tax credit. We look to private debt from lenders like NOAA or other lenders in the community. And then the final gap piece that we look to is grants from the trust fund and from HOME and CDBG and other local programs that are able to support affordable housing. Each piece contributes together to create the package of affordability. So it is hard to say that this $1 bought this particular segment of affordability because it really is all blended together. But as a whole, they do create that affordability. One of the things I think the department might speak to a little bit more is that they are increasingly focusing on how to meet the greatest needs in communities and how to ensure that the dollars go to meet those needs. And that is certainly something that is part of the mission of the nonprofit developers and owners that work in the program.
If I can just tag on two quick points. One is that this is going to be distributed right within existing processes, so we're not going to create any new administration for the program administration, so it'll be efficient from that standpoint. And the other is that there is a huge oversubscribed appetite for these resources. We have projects that are worthy and ready to proceed. There just wasn't the resources available to fund them. They're just waiting. If we had money, we could start tomorrow, and we could probably do a dozen projects tomorrow without even having to ask for any new applications, to be honest. So there's pent-up demand. The projects are queued up and ready to go, and we have an existing process for administering the resource. So it'll be very efficient, I believe.
And this may be an unfair, this may be a Victor Merced question, but do you know what percentage would have equity in of recipients? And if you don't, just... I'm sure someone in the room does, some ballpark percentage that that would not be renting, that would have equity in their home.
And I don't think I can answer that question.
We can.
We've got, I mean, a portion of the money is intended to go into a homeownership program. We have a trust fund already set up for homeownership grants. Typically, those grants have been for down payment assistance or for training, helping people clean up their credit and figure out how to go through a home. We want to increase the amount of money available through the revenue from Senate Bill 38 and possibly use some of that money to help subsidize construction of single-family homes for home ownership. The percentage is listed in one of Janet's handouts because I edited it yesterday, and I don't know where it is. But some of that money, we'll get the number for you.
Great. Thank you.
In Portland, the Community Development Network, which is the trade association of nonprofits that work in Multnomah County, has produced over 7,000 units in total. I'm going to guess that at least 10% of those have been homeownership units.
Homeownership. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time this morning. Okay, so we're going to break the order just so that we allow folks who are not in favor of this an opportunity. Mr. Morales, Ms. Coleman, and if there are others, Jim, if you're here and want to voice your concerns, I don't see you.
Hi.
Hi, good morning. Matt, do y'all want to voice your concerns at this point, or Jim's here? If you want to, you can. If not, you can continue to.
Hi.
Good morning.
Morning. James Morales, Benton County Records and Elections Manager, and I'm here representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks. I have provided some written testimony for Senator Dickert and members of the committee to review. Just going over the points that we tried to make in our testimony here today, the clerks at our midwinter conference made a decision to oppose this particular legislation, although we do recognize the value of the work that is being done and the importance of what is trying to be accomplished here. The concerns of the clerks are the venue at which the proposed fee is or the fundraising mechanism is being proposed. By placing a recording fee on the documents that the Housing Alliance and others have proposed, one thing is they go outside of the precedence that has been set for fees that are placed on recording. These fees have always related to the maintenance of the real property records and the services that the county and state provide that relates to real property records and tax collection. Our concern is once we go outside of that precedence, the door is wide open to any type of worthy effort to come forward to place additional fees on these recordings. Another concern is that the administrative costs that we will incur, there are going to be costs associated with collecting this fee, as the funding mechanism that the bill is proposing to use relates to the assessment and taxation portion of the fee collection. Now, we do collect, track, audit, and distribute these fees to the State Department of Revenue for the assessment and taxation programs that are supported by these funds. This does not go to the same place. These funds do not go to the same place. They go to different entities, and different funding tracking sources will have to be developed, different auditing, additional auditing practices will have to be followed to track these funds. We're going to be handling, as the group said, close to $30 million. There is going to be costs associated with handling these funds. Anytime you've got additional monies that need to be tracked and audited and transferred, there are processes that need to be set up. This bill circumvents our ability to collect the administrative costs, as the assessment and taxation portion of the statute allows the county to collect 5% for the clerk's administrative costs, 5% for the county's administrative costs, which would be the treasurer, the finance department's auditing and transferring of those particular funds as well. So not only does this go outside of previous legislative intent, which previous legislative bodies have always stuck to, this has to be real property related, any fees that go on these recordings. And on the back of the handout at the top of the page, we try to put that into some language here that this has always been, past legislative bodies have always limited, and it's in the language, the current statute clearly limits the fees collected to real property related functions that are performed by the county. So I will allow Jan Coleman and others to speak as well.
Thank you.
If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer as well. Thank you for allowing me to share.
You bet. Ms. Coleman.
Chair Deckard and members of the committee, I'm Jan Coleman. I'm the Yamhill County Clerk, and I'm also representing the Association of County Clerks today. I don't have a lot to add to what James said. James said it very well. We're certainly in sympathy with what is being proposed. You know, the clerks can't deny that there is a need out there. We're just saying that we don't like being the venue here. I have to be truthful. If this passes, I think at my recording windows, I'm going to post something that says, it costs you $5 to record. The rest of the fees that you are paying are for other things. And basically, that makes us a tax collector. So it's really hard to tell the 80-year-olds who just lost a spouse and they bring in a death certificate to record with us so that the title is cleared and it shows that just one person would be signing off to sell their property, that now with this additional $15, it's going to cost them $41 to record that document. $5 is our fee, okay? The rest are other things. With other proposals that are before legislature, we really don't know how much it's going to cost that person to record, because there are other bills out there that are wanting to tack on to recording also. So while we recognize the need for what is being proposed here, we really think there should be another venue here. And it's, as James said, we do have administrative costs. My people face the people that are coming in to record every day. And that in itself, trying to explain to these people what all these costs are for, becomes a time-consuming thing. So it's not something that's just you know, happens. There are a lot of things on our side, too.
Yeah, and I might add just a little bit that these fees, it would be $56 in Fenton County, by the way, because we have the geographic information system fee that got grandfathered in before some of the fees were limited. Now, what would happen in the case of, say, a subcontractor wants to record a lien against $400 owed on some drywall or something, that work that he'd done. The cost for the lien and the release would be over $100. That contractor, if he got paid, that contractor would be out over 25% of what he's trying to collect just by putting securing some interest in this real estate that he's trying to get his payment for. So there's other constituents that would be affected by these types of fees.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Yeah, please, Senator George.
It would appear then that the state would require you to be worse than payday lenders.
That's correct.
Thank you very much. Appreciate bringing your perspective to us. It's important to hear. Mr. Markey, I don't want to put you on the spot. I know you're just continuing to work this issue. So,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. Jim Markey on behalf of the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association. I did not sign up in opposition to the bill. I'd like the record to reflect that. The Mortgage Lenders Association is comprised of mortgage departments from banks, and we have credit unions and non-depository mortgage lenders. Our members recognize the need for affordable housing probably as much as anybody in the room, and in fact many of our members partner on the very programs that you're hearing about from the proponents of this bill. We have wrestled with this issue of affordable housing for a bunch of years. And I think the proponents are moving forward in a way that they deem necessary, because very little has been done with respect to affordable housing in this state. I think the very first witness you heard today said it best when he said that the Housing Alliance believes that affordable housing needs to be a priority for state funding. And it never has been. So today we're looking at a proposal that would add another surcharge to recorded documents, a blank in the bill, but the proponents would like $15. We have, as you know, an $11 surcharge for assessment and for mapping. Most counties, which you won't see in the bill, are now charging a $10. I'm going to try and see if I can get this correct. Maybe you can help me. Land corner preservation fee, which apparently helps the counties establish corners for survey purposes, which again is a benefit to lenders and home buyers and home sellers and everyone. These are all laudable causes, but we keep adding fees. And I find it somewhat ironic that we're all concerned about the affordability of housing and the difficulty that people have to save enough money to get into a home, and then we continue to add these fees to the front end of buying a home, which I'm to think that's a little ironic. This $15 fee, if it were $15, probably in and of itself isn't going to prevent somebody from buying a home. We see anywhere from 1 to 5 documents being recorded. So it might not be $15. It might be 30 or 45 or 60. I mean, we don't, you know, not $15 in every case. Having said all that, I think that the Mortgage Lenders Association will not oppose some kind of a fee being added. I think we'd prefer that it be less than $15. And I think that we would like to see this as part of a broad-based commitment by you And that would include, and I talked with one of the co-chairs this morning about the need for general fund in this area. Now, the Housing Alliance has a proposal for general fund. It's in the governor's budget, governor's proposed budget. I'm told that it's not being met with great enthusiasm by some members of the legislative body. We think that it needs to be an integral part of this funding proposal, and that there ought to be as much general fund as in this proposal as there is from the home buyers themselves through this fee. There's also some lottery dollars. I think that's great. Oddly enough, the one group of people who will be purchasing homes that will be totally exempt from any fee will be people buying mobile homes or manufactured housing. And you heard Mr. Van Landingham say that we're going to use some of this money to help those folks in those parks where they're being closed. It seems to me, because and the reason they won't pay this is because unless they're putting it on real property, it's never recorded with the county. So it probably doesn't raise a lot of money. But as a matter of fairness, it seems to me people buying manufactured homes should be paying some kind of a fee up front, too, if we're going to do that for homeowners. So having said that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Appreciate getting your comments. Senator George.
I suppose this is for my county clerks here, we've heard this budget, of course, in Ways and Means, Transportation, Economic Development. And we also heard from OLCC the other day in which the governor's plan calls for taking $17 million out of the pockets of the county in order to get more money, of course, for the state. And it appears to me that what we've done here is to put you in the position of becoming a tax collector for us. And I really kind of resent that because I think it's an unfunded mandate. And Jan, and so that's one question. Second question, there was a lot of discussion still going on about, collecting tolls on the cars you drive. And part of the plan, you probably read about it, is that you will drive into a service station, you'll pay your gas tax as part of your gas bill, then your service station attendant will tell you owe another $8 or $9. And your thought about putting that person in that low-income worker in the part of trying to collect that money, who's going to receive the adversarial treatment? It's going to be that person who's collecting the money. Do you see that as being the case relative to those two questions?
Well,
do you want me to take
that? Yeah. Senator George, members of the committee. Yes, we already do answer quite a bit of these types of questions. As a matter of fact, a lot of our out-of-state customers are shocked at our current fees as compared to what it is in other states. And so we do have to field these questions already, and I believe that they will increase as our fees increase. One of the things that I did not mention, but I wanted to get in and mention here, was that the clerks wanted to also make it aware that we think it's really feeling the crunch right now with the loss of the ONC revenues, and we wanted to make it clear that we wanted to see existing programs and services that are being provided by the counties receive funding and be supported, perhaps even through the fees, before we go out and support efforts that are new or outside of what's already being delivered by the counties.
I know this is anecdotal, so have you had folks that are particularly sensitive about walked away, said, I'm not paying these document recording fees, therefore...
You want to take this one?
I'll take this one. Chair Deckard, members of the committee, yes, we do get that already. I have to tell you, I've been in this a little longer than James, and when the A&T fee came along, my staff, some of this is jest, but some of it is very true. They wanted to know if we were going to get bulletproof brass, because when we first started telling the people about this additional fee on recording. People get upset. You know, all particularly they'll say, all I want to do is, you know, record this document, put it on the record. Yes, we understand that. So, yes, you do get that. In most cases, most of them will go ahead and record because it's something they need to do. Sometimes they go away and come back another day because at the time they don't have the fees and they have to save up to do that. So it is something that is reality.
Thank you. It's always the dilemma that we face of we have sometimes a public that certainly for good reasons wants, whether it's affordable housing or better investments in education, and then when you're paying for it, it's always where the rubber hits the road or the nail hits the hammer in this case, and that's always the challenge. But we appreciate your perspective. It's important to get. Appreciate Jim putting your concerns or thoughts.
Mr. Chairman, sometimes
yes, Senator George.
The end does not justify the means.
Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it does. Ms. Bruce, Mr. Moorfield, Ms. Allen, and Dr. Dondero on deck.
Good morning, Chair Deckert and committee members. I'm Renee Bruce, Director of Family and Community Resources at Community Action, located in Washington County. And I believe you've been handed a handout.
Slowly making its way
okay.
to us. So if you could.
Okay. And it'll show what the increase, the document recording fees, the effect it'll have on the Community Action programs in the emergency housing account. As you know, Washington County continues to be one of the fastest growing counties in Oregon, but what many people do not realize is that our increase in people living in poverty is growing at a faster rate than our general population. At Community Action, we are made aware daily of the needs people living in poverty have. One of the biggest needs of those we serve is the need for affordable housing. The passage of Senate Bill 38 is very important to the work we do with homeless families and individuals and those at risk of being homeless in Washington County. Currently, the emergency housing account funds are used to support three programs in our housing and homeless network of services. Open Door Counseling Center provides day shelter to single adults. Domestic Violent Resource Center provides shelter to women experiencing domestic violence. The Community Action Family Shelter provides shelter to families with children. With the level of EHA funding we have now, we continue to turn away many that are in desperate need of assistance. For example, during the month of November, 460 households sought emergency rental assistance to avoid eviction, and we were only able to assist 40. And I'm going to go a little off my plan here and say, after hearing the county clerks, which I appreciate hearing their testimony, my staff have to turn away people every day that need assistance for housing. So I think they also feel that they need the bulletproof vest. So I just wanted to add that. Last year, a total of 614 women and their children were turned away from the county's domestic violence shelter. During October, 108 families sought emergency shelter. Our Washington County Shelter Network has the capacity to serve 17 families at a time, and we're always full. Last summer, 193 individuals, 72 of which were identified as chronically homeless, accessed the county's drop-in center to receive day shelter services. And currently, there are no shelter for single adults in Washington County, even though that's kind of online for us. Increased funding would allow us to maintain and improve housing and homeless services for families and individuals. For example, we would be able to serve an additional 34 households each month with emergency rental assistance to prevent eviction and hopefully homelessness, and another 85 families each year with long-term rental assistance, including much-needed supportive services. Providing emergency and long-term rent assistance to prevent homelessness would allow families to move through our shelter system a little more quickly and would decrease the demand on the limited number of shelter beds that we have in Washington County. EHA funds allow us the flexibility to address the needs of those we serve in a way that best fits our county. An increased, ongoing, stable source of funding would enable us to better address the housing needs we have in Washington County and, as you've heard today, in Oregon. We really need your support on this issue, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you.
My name is Jim Moorfield. I'm Executive Director with Willamette Neighborhood Housing Services. We serve Lynn and Benton counties with offices in Corvallis and Lebanon. I'm here to talk about the home ownership component of Senate Bill 38. 9% of the revenue generated by this bill would be devoted to home ownership. While that may be a relatively modest percentage of the overall revenues, helping people get into home ownership serves a segment of the population where the amount of subsidy is needed is less than would be needed to serve someone who's homeless, for instance, and might not be able to afford very much in the way of rent. So affordable housing covers a lot of territory and a lot of markets within the population of people we call low income. By setting aside 9% of the document recording fee for home ownership, this bill will allow for activities that we know work in helping people buy their first home. And I would summarize that as three legs to a stool. One is education and one-on-one counseling to help people learn how to do this for the first time. It's very complicated. And that may include financial literacy training for people that have credit issues that have to be repaired before they can buy their first home. The second leg of the stool is financial assistance. There's a big gap between what people can afford and what it costs to buy a house. That gap varies considerably around the state. But whatever the size of that gap, down payment assistance, second mortgages, affordable first mortgages, and other approaches that do a similar thing like community land trusts are needed. And then finally, the last leg of the stool is having actual homes to buy. A few days ago, I checked the multiple listings in Corvallis and found 14 homes listed on the market for under $200,000. We have more people taking our class in a month than that. So there's a considerable lack of supply. Now, one of the things I like about the uses of these monies is that it can be very flexible to meet local needs. In Corvallis, for instance, we have all the small starter homes that someone might have been able to buy in the past are all been sucked up into the rental market now. In another community like Albany, there may be small homes that come on the market that are available. So what Albany needs is not new construction. Acquisition rehab and down payment assistance will work in a community like Albany. In Corvallis, we need some new construction. Another example about both need and opportunity, one of the largest segments of the market for first-time home buyers, one of the largest growth in the market for making loans to first-time home buyers has been among minority households. We have nonprofit organizations in many communities that are ready to assist minority households in getting into a good financial deal, one that makes sense, and one that will help preserve home ownership over time. And so we see a wonderful partnership between what the private sector wants to do in making loans and building homes and what we want to do in helping people make good financial choices in their life. I want to end on a personal note. 23 years ago, my parents helped my wife and I buy our first home. We were low income. We just had our second child. And our parents helped us out with down payment assistance. We also got some assistance from the city of Corvallis and a housing rehab loan and so on. Then last year, my kids both got married in the same year. So they have new spouses. My daughter is a dance teacher in Portland, and her husband is with the National Guard in Afghanistan right now. My son works at a grocery store in Eugene, and he's married to a high school teacher. Our gift to them was down payment towards a house. They're not quite ready to buy a house. Their lives are a little unsettled at the moment, but in the next few years they will be. My concern is that even with our help, they're not going to be able to close the gap, because the gap between what people are making and what it costs to buy a house is getting larger every day. So with your help, we might be able to make the American dream come true for them. Thanks.
Thank you. Personal stories are helpful to make it more realistic or bring reality to it. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Deckert and members of the committee. My name is Kate Allen. I'm the director in Portland with Enterprise Community Partners. Many of you know Enterprise is a national organization established 25 years ago and dedicated to providing financing and training and technical assistance to help communities and residents in those communities achieve affordable home ownership or affordable housing of a whole range. The Housing Alliance proposal would dedicate 6% of the document recording fee revenues to capacity building activities, that is, building the response capacity of community-based nonprofit organizations, like many that you've heard represented from around the state today. I am pleased today to speak to you and provide specific examples of how current capacity building resources, and that's one of the things that Enterprise brings to this activity, are used and leveraged, and present you some examples of needs on the horizon. As with other revenues generated by the Housing Alliance proposals, our expectation is that these resources would be distributed through competitive processes to community-based partners to respond directly to priority community needs. These are the capable organizations who are working within communities on the specific needs that rise up out of those communities. For over 10 years, there have been efforts, first in Portland and then since 7 years ago statewide, to cooperate and coordinate capacity-building funding activities. The funder's goals are to maximize housing production that responds to community needs and to build stable organizations that are capable of long-term stewardship of the housing that is built with public dollars and private investment. Capacity building remains a priority, but existing funds through Enterprise and the Neighborhood Partnership Fund are decreasing and shifting, and despite our best efforts, that's happening at the same time that the community needs are demanding creative and complex responses. I wanted to highlight some specific recent experience that we've had with the power of a small investment in the capacity of community-based organizations. In the funding year 2005-2006, Enterprise invested $724,000, which was leveraged in partnership with Oregon Housing and Community Services and the City of Portland, investing together about $1 million in that same activity across the state. That yielded 3,632 units of affordable housing that were built or preserved in that period of time. And that goes through the end of June 2006. And some real innovative examples of how those community capacity building funds were utilized were the development of joint capacity for managing the assets and developing more housing across two small organizations that could partner and do that better in a broader community together. Co-sharing of staff resources for housing specialists and bookkeepers, and other examples like a cooperative buying of materials to control costs across several organizations. To do this capacity building, the partners have leveraged other resources. Enterprise brings in HUD resources out of a small capacity building account, as well as private money and training dollars that have been provided by philanthropic organizations. We now see the need for increased capacity and technical expertise by our community-based organizations to address the issues around manufactured home parks, preservation of existing housing in the communities, and special needs housing. Those owners will need to adapt and learn how to work with new populations and addressing the needs of minority homeowners, energy-efficient mortgages, and reclamation of brownfields and other land opportunities. In order for them to do that, the small 6% increase or small 6% of the document recording fee proposed by Senate Bill 38 would be extremely useful, and thank you very much for your for the opportunity to speak in it.
Thank you, Ms. Allen. We are coming up against a Senate floor session that is starting here as you see the members going to their office and then to the floor, and so that's what we're up against. Folks who want to testify can, and I can stay, but it is up to you. So you can just wave when I call your name, and we'll schedule this again. We need to get the amendments printed, and then the folks that are working this issue also need to let me know the vote count, because that's always constitutionally important to know that answer. Thank you very much. So I'll continue to call folks' names. If you want to testify now, let me know. If you want to wait until the full committee is here, they're on the Senate floor here in a moment. You can take the next opportunity. Dr. Dondero, Selma and Clarence Eckstein. And if you're someone that doesn't get to the Capitol regularly, if you could also let me know, because we have other folks that are here often.
I'm going to make this real short. You have my testimony. I will come back when the full committee has the opportunity to meet on this issue again. But let me add this as a P.S. The state of Washington has a documents tax or fee which is related to the same issue of affordable housing. That's number one. That's come up. And to me, philosophically, this kind of fee helps local residents help people in their own community get into affordable housing, whether it's rental or otherwise. So it seems to me that, you know, we're helping one another as we ought to in this community and in the state. I'll reserve the rest of my comments to another time. Thank you.
Thank you. And Dr. Dondero, I think it's important to mention to the, so I would save that comment for the full committee when we schedule this again, because I think that's the crux to this debate is, and was unaware of the Washington.
Yeah. Thank you.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning. My name is Clarence Eckstein, and I'm just here to say why I think this is so important to me. And I've been in it for, say, going on 7 years. And if it wasn't for, you know, being able to afford housing and whatever, I'd probably be on the street. And I just recently moved back here from Nebraska and didn't have no place to go. And I went to Beverly Hughes. And I told her, I said, brother, I said, I need a place. And they had a place coming open, and they made it handicapped just for me. I mean, you know, that's, to me, that's important. You know, myself, I think, you know, I've seen a lot of houses around town that are just standing vacant, you know, old houses, wherever, that can be fixed up for people to live in, you know. And I feel, you know, that if people took more time to look at things like that and listen to people, you know, you wouldn't have so many people on the street, you know. But to me, the whole thing is important, you know. And I don't know, that's about all I can say, really. It's, you know, it's telling how I feel.
Mm-hmm. Well, sir, that's, I can tell you, hearing statistics and numbers is helpful.
But I'm deaf, my right ear.
And I probably mumble. It's like that Seinfeld episode. Hearing statistics and numbers is really, really important, but actually hearing people's stories and hearing about you coming back from Nebraska and looking for a house makes it obviously much, much more meaningful to see folks that the program helps.
Thank you.
Hopefully we all stay dry here in this deluge. Okay, Ms. Lori Dwight, Cindy Cook, and we got Kate Allen and Alex Coyler are the names that...
Hi.
Good morning.
I'm Lori Dwight, and I'm a client of Human Solutions Affordable Housing in Portland.
I've been in the housing where I'm at now for just a little over 2 years. I was homeless for a year before that with my daughter, who's four, living with family but in stressful situations. With my dad, I was in a camper outside with no heat, no water, so I had to come in and out of the house. They lived in a 1,200 square foot home, so it wasn't ideal. In fact, my daughter had to stay in because I couldn't keep her warm enough. So I was very desperate for housing when this opportunity came along. I was struggling with the homelessness issue, and I had called the crisis line through Cascadia and started taking some life skills courses or classes, but I suddenly realized that I couldn't really apply any of those skills because I was living out of a suitcase. I didn't have a drawer. I didn't have a space. I had a place to sleep, but I didn't have a lifestyle where I could really apply all these things. So once I quickly realized that, because I've been homeless before 15 years ago due to drug addiction, I realized I needed the housing again to get this taken care of. So once I called them, they referred me to Human Solutions, and the housing came pretty quickly. But since then, I've been able to really identify the barriers that I have to employment that were never addressed during the drug addiction part. I think back then they weren't really addressing both mental health issues at the same time with drug addiction as they are now. And so now I'm dealing with the mental health issue part. My physical health as well, just being really ready to look at some of the past issues that I've had, not just the drug addiction, but domestic violence. And I'm so tapped into all the services, and without the agency services, you know, housing, you know, it takes more than just the housing, but without the housing, you can't really utilize the services either. Once we got into our home, it was a place where we could function and build a routine. And my daughter at one point, I think she was two, she said, "How come we don't have a home? We always stay with grandma or auntie or friends." And she said, "Where's our home?" And so now we have one. And it's been our home for 2 years, and I have long-term goals now that I never had before. And you know, sitting in this room hearing all this information, it's amazing because I don't really see that far into my future. I'm just working day to day on what I can. So it's exciting, and I'm very grateful, but it sounds like there's even more for me in store that I just haven't, I'm not ready for, or haven't been there yet. But, you know, I don't think that far ahead because the housing is taken care of, so I can really focus on everything else. I probably have another year and a half to really become fully self-sufficient. I always think it's going to be quicker than it is, but it's a long process once you're down, rebuilding your life back up again and being really able to stand on your own 2 feet and go forward. So even though I get anxious and think I'm ready, I know there's more to do. So thank you for your time.
Oh, well, thank you. I think it's very courageous to come to the State Senate and testify before a committee, and it helps us to hear stories. And I can't imagine with insecure housing how you can do all the other things that you would want to do.
Well, this housing that I'm in is stable, so that was that's the only reason I'm able to do all this, is that relief. You know, I don't have the pressure of doing it all right away, knowing that those barriers are going to come up again. You know, it's short term if I do that track, and this is a long term.
Great. Well, thanks for coming to the Capitol
today.
Thank
you, and I can come back for the panel.
Oh, good. Good. Yeah. It'll go to the House too. This is a long, arduous process. Just trying to get it moving.
All right.
Cindy Cook? No. Victor, do you want to now, or do you want to come back the next? I think the full committee would benefit from having you.
I agree, Mr. Chair. I think I'd like to testify when all the members are present. I think it's important that they hear the department's testimony on this bill.
Yeah, I do too. Thanks,
okay.
Mr. Merced.
Thank you.
And then Linda and Mr. Snyder, the cities and counties. I don't even see Linda. There she is. She's waving off. Which puts more pressure on you, Mr. Snyder, to wave off. But you don't have to.
I'm here all the time.
Okay. We'll reschedule. I'm told March 5th we'll get the amendments, so we'll reschedule after March 5th. Thank you very much for everyone who came. We'll look to reschedule this hearing, another hearing and possible work session after March 5th. Thank you. We are now closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 38 and adjourning the City Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue.